A tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
As listeners to the morning show know, it is not all that often that I take time with a work of fiction on this program. Nonfiction is much more the steady diet of the morning show in terms of books and authors. But I am absolutely thrilled that I was persuaded to take a closer look at what has turned out to be one of the most celebrated and talked about novels before the public right now. A novel called Kitchens of the Great Midwest, and it is the debut novel of a talented writer by the name of J. Ryan Straddle. And Kitchens of the Great Midwest is extraordinary on many, many different levels. And it is a work that is richly personal, not only in its depiction of sort of a central character whose through line is steadily present in one way or another throughout the novel, but all of the other interesting characters and interesting places where this story takes us as we pivot from one perspective to another. And through it all, we are following the development, the blossoming, really, of a woman by the name of Eva Torvald, who, out of very unpromising circumstances, rises to be an extraordinarily accomplished chef. And her own relationship with food and the way in which food is a very powerful personal expression for her comes shining through. And the role that food and the preparation and sharing of food plays in other people's lives plays out as well. This novel is just so richly crafted, and I'm excited to be able to talk about it with J. Randall Straddle. As I said, this is his first novel. He's a gifted writer whose actually first published work was a short story, and his work has appeared in a lot of different places. And Mr. Straddle has also done a lot of work in the realm of television, and reality television in particular. And we may take a moment or two to talk about that work as well. But chiefly we're here to talk about his marvelous novel, Kitchens of the Great Midwest, now available in paperback from Penguin Books. J. Ryan Straddle, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. And first of all, I got to say, that was as succinct and wonderful a description as my book as I've ever heard.
Well,
I wish I knew you when I was in this position of having completed the book and looking for an agent, because I had such a hard time figuring out how to describe this book. And I know as an author, that's probably often the case. You know, it feels like these characters in my book are my family.
Mm. They certainly come off that way. And I have to say, one of the reasons I loved this book so much is exactly because it's not easy to categorize or pinhole or summarize. And when you think about it, a whole lot of books that are on the bestseller shelves are almost obscenely easy to summarize, because it's one more thriller from author X or one more romantic novel from author Y. And this is a novel that plays out like nothing I've ever read before. So I'm just thrilled to be able to talk with you about it, to find out more about where it springs from and how you put this wonderful book together. Could we begin, however, with your own background and beyond the fact that you happen to have been born and raised in the Midwest, the fact that you have had a fervent love affair with books from just about as long as you've been able to read. Tell us about your early childhood in Hastings, Minnesota, and in particular, the very important role that books played in your childhood from a very early age.
Yeah. I'd love to. Yeah, I was born in Waconia, Minnesota. Didn't spend much time there. But my family moved around through southeastern Minnesota. I lived in a community called Jonathan, which is now part of Chaska, and then Owatonna, and then finally Hastings. And I learned to read at a pretty young age thanks to my mom. My mom was a big reader, and she went back to college when I was a little kid. She was in her 30s. She had never completed her English degree, so she returned to the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and got her degree. And while she was studying, while she was an undergraduate, while she was balancing the life of being a college student and a mom to two kids, she would read us her homework as bedtime stories. And I just loved it. I just saw this parent, you know, reading, writing, and being really passionate about it, and that really made a strong impression on me. It was a big influence in my life, as were, you know, and I don't mention this as much, but I also want to mention the teachers I had. I had a second grade teacher, Gretchen Caldwell, who was incredibly supportive of a, you know, little kid in her class who was writing in the margins of math assignments. Like, you'd get these math assignments with dimes and quarters and pennies on them, and you had to add them up. Instead, I would draw word bubbles and have them talk to each other. And she would actually give me extra points for that. I mean, I would also do the math. I'd add up the coins, but I'd also have them have a conversation with each other. And I really appreciate having a teacher that, you know, didn't mind it, you know, or, like, gave me the latitude to be a little creative, because I felt like I had stories to tell, and it was so important to me in the way that I saw the world, the way I related to the world, that it was really wonderful to have a teacher like Gretchen and a school librarian, an elementary school librarian like Carolyn Schultz, who let me hang out there after school. You know, let me come there when, you know, things were tough for me. If I was bullied or something, I could go to the library and hang out, and she'd give me projects to do. And it was, it was a sanctuary.
Wow.
I mean, books were, but they weren't just a place I escaped to, but they were a place that helped me define who I was, and also felt like messages in a bottle from the outside world that told me that there was a place for me. Because growing up in a small Midwestern hockey town, I didn't always inherently feel that.
Right.
And certainly I wasn't always one of the more, you know, outgoing or, you know, popular kids at times. So it made me feel like, hey, there, you know, my crowd's out there somewhere.
Just maybe not here in Hastings.
Yeah.
Although I loved how in an interview you described your parents and the librarians there as your little literary community in Hastings, Minnesota.
Yeah.
And I so appreciate the fact that, for instance, you know the name of your elementary school librarian. I mean, the library and books were important to me too, but I can't even conjure up the face, let alone the name of any of the librarians in the schools where I was, and maybe I never forged quite the personal connection that you did with yours. But on the other hand, I think it's great that you appreciate and remember your school librarians to the extent that you do. That must warm their hearts, I should think.
Oh yeah, and I just want to shout out to all the librarians. I mean, you're making such a difference in the lives of people. I mean, my town didn't have a bookstore. Between my elementary school library and the city library, that was where I went. And those places were the education outside of my education. And if it wasn't for the concerned adults in those places, I wouldn't be here now. Between my parents, you know, the local librarians and the supportive teachers, I mean, those names I feel like deserve to be on the cover of the book as much as mine. I feel like they laid the foundation for letting me know that it was possible to be a writer in the first place, and then encouraging it on top of that.
I love another story I heard in another interview where you talk about really dreaming from the age of maybe 5 or 6 of yourself becoming an author, of writing a book someday. Would you mind sharing with our listeners what you would do with certain books at that very, very young age? This is wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I saw my mom reading a lot. And like a lot of little kids, you know, you want your parents' attention. You see what your parents are paying attention to instead of you, you know, what they're conferring their attention upon. And I think, you know, a couple of thoughts might cross your head at that point. Like, do I run interference there? Do I get between them and what they're trying to pay attention to? Or do I try to do what they're paying attention to? And since my mom was a college student at the time and doing a lot of reading and putting a lot of importance in books, I thought, I know, I'll write a book. That'll impress her, you know? And I loved books, too, and I wanted to write, you know, I wanted to write a book as much for myself, but I felt it would really impress my mom if I was an author. So what I did to be an author was take my favorite book, Richard Scarry's Cars and Trucks and Things That Go, and I wrote, written by Ryan Straddle on the inside cover in crayon. And I gave it to my mom, and I said, here's my book. This is how it's done, right? You take text, it doesn't matter where it's from, you know, it could be someone else, and you just claim it, you know, and now it's mine. And she said, nope, that's not how it's done. You got to make up the words yourself. And I thought, oh, what? Oh, I was kind of bummed for a little while, but then I thought it over, and I thought, well, I can do that. You know, that's not impossible. All right, okay. And I started making comic strips after that. That was my first foray into creative writing was drawing my own comics, you know. And then eventually, once we started getting short story assignments in elementary school, or once we got assignments that were had the creative latitude to write prose, I took them, and I started writing short stories. But, my first foray into being a novelist was just a
attach your name to something else.
Exactly. I just outwardly plagiarized Richard Scarry. Yeah.
One thing that surprised me a bit was, given this ferocious love you had of books and this intention from such an early age to be a writer someday. If I understand correctly, you didn't actually go to college to study that specifically. I mean, you didn't go to college as a creative writing major. Just how did you end up pursuing this interest?
Well, I always knew I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't feel like I was going to make a living at it. I didn't assume that. My entire life writing stories, I felt like this is something I enjoy doing, but I knew enough about it even as a teenager to know that there's not a lot of people make a living as a fiction writer. So I figured I've got to figure out something to do to support myself while I write. And I thought, well, what's another creative career? It's interesting. I decided to start working on film and TV sets in Minnesota during the summer as a PA, as a production assistant. As a gopher, you know, fetching coffee, wrapping cables, that kind of stuff. And I found those jobs. I started doing those jobs, and I enrolled at Northwestern as a radio TV film major. And that was great. I mean, that was a really creative time, and I continued writing short stories. And I even took one fiction class. It was mostly reading fiction. I think we only wrote one story the entire quarter. But for the most part, I was also too intimidated to write fiction seriously. Even though I was doing it a lot, I felt like it's really hard that this would be something I'd put off until my 40s. You know, I'll start writing novels. and it almost worked out like that. Kitchens came out when I was 39. But... And it's also probably not bad advice in a sense. I don't know if I would have, I certainly wouldn't have had the patience or the skill to write something like Kitchens 10 years ago or even 5 years ago.
Right.
Yeah,
I also understand
a lifetime of reading and writing to get to this point.
Right. As you describe the way all of this took off, I think I've heard you talk about how your very first attempt at being published was successful, just like that. It was a short story. It was published by the first publisher you sent it to, and you sort of mistakenly assumed, this is going to be even easier than I thought. And then I don't remember how many years went by where you experienced rejection upon rejection upon rejection. I thought one of the interesting things you described in that period was that one of the most helpful things you did, besides continuing to write, was to do more reading. Yeah. In what way was that, do you think, helpful to you?
Oh, it's immensely helpful. I don't think you can be a good writer without being a great reader, and a reader of diversity and volume. that's probably what changed my life the most, was the 4 years of reading I did between 2006 and 2010. I also started taking extension classes at UCLA, and so I got to know writing instructors. I was working on new material, even if it wasn't being published, and revising it with under the eye of published writers. So that was helpful. But what I think I got from them and from the people in my life at the time that was as if not more helpful than writing instruction was book recommendations, and not just contemporary ones, classic book recommendations. There were a lot of classic books I'd never read. I got into those. I was reading about two books a week at one point, just plowing through all these books, and they really changed how I thought about writing. I don't think you can help but evolve as a serious writer if you read thoughtfully. And I would take my time with these books, and a few of the books I read during this period I've read again since and gotten more from them, reading them with a certain point of view, like, how did this author do this? Now, I try not to be too analytical the first time I read a book. Sometimes I can't help it. I know here in Los Angeles, it can be a hassle to go to a film with someone who's a director or a screenwriter or an editor, because they can't help but comment on technical aspects that they see. And it can be like that as a writer. I also work as an editor at a small press called Unnamed. And, you see the tricks the writers are pulling. And you try not to let that distract you too much from the narrative, because one of the best feelings in the world is getting sucked into a story. And you want to give yourself the permission to do that as a reader. But as a writer and editor, it can be hard to turn off those valves of perception.
Right. Before we delve into this novel specifically, I have to ask you about the work that you have been doing in recent years out there in Los Angeles in the TV industry, and particularly in the reality TV industry. I only want to ask about that because I'm curious to know if that is something that exists entirely unto itself, as though encased in a bubble, as just this other thing you do quite apart from your work as a writer, and particularly the crafting of this beautiful novel set in a very different part of the country. And populated, I should think, at least for the most part, by very different people than those that you work with in the TV industry. I mean, how do we fold this into who you are as a writer? And what effect, if any, does it have on you as a writer?
Wow. I'd say that my reality TV work had quite a bit of effect on my writing in a certain sense. When you're putting together unscripted television, you're working with what's been shot. And I mostly worked in post-production as a story producer and later on a supervising producer, organizing the story material for the show and figuring out what the essential material was through which we would draw the narrative. And it's a lot of work that you have to get right the first time, especially on a show like Deadliest Catch, where there are tens of thousands of hours of footage, and you have to make a 42-minute episode out of it. You're watching this tape. You have to, you know, you watch an interview, and you have to know the first time you watch the interview what lines you're going to use. You know, you just develop an ear for the necessary, for the essential, and you pull those together, and you see where your story is at. And it helped me write what I thought was an overly concise first draft of Kitchens, you know, because I'm looking at every sentence the way I would look at a sentence on Deadliest Catch or Storage Wars. And believe me, it may not look like it, but every sentence on those shows is scrutinized and seen dozens and dozens of times before it hits the air. Like nothing gets by us. You know, we're looking at every frame of that of each episode as to its utility. Because what happens is, you know, you're trying to get an episode down to 42 minutes. I can't tell you how many times I've seen rough cuts of Deadliest Catch episodes that were like an hour and 5 minutes long that were just immaculate, you know, that were like, wow, this could air. This is a great show, this hour and 5 minute long cut. And we've got to get it down to 42.
Mm.
And just thinking like that every day, like looking at every sentence that somebody says and thinking like, oh, we can lose that. There's 8 seconds right there, that sentence. All right, there's 5 seconds, that phrase. Oh, there's that whole speech that guy gives right there. That's 45 seconds. Let's, you know, there we go. And just that winnowing then created in the back of my mind a really harsh editorial mentality in terms of my own first draft. When my book got to Pam Dorman at Penguin, she ended up adding about 20 pages, which probably isn't the usual editorial experience, but it had to be done for me because I was, in some places, a little too concise. And I've loosened the reins on my next book. The first draft of my next book is typical novelist bloat. It's 529 pages, and I've got to get it way down. So it feels good to, you know, that I'm not completely beholden to the editorial mindset that directed the type of writing I did the first time, that I can let loose and expand scenes and linger in scenes and develop interior texture for the characters. I mean, I wasn't compelled to do that as much for the first draft of Kitchens. I felt like I just got to tell the story.
With sort of breathless eagerness.
Oh, yeah, 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 lots of alacrity and pulchritude. Yeah, I felt like the first draft of Kitchens was, and it just kind of burst out of me.
Hmm. I believe it. There's even that quality as we read the finished product, I mean, very much. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with J. Ryan Straddle, and we're talking about his much-celebrated novel, also his first novel, called Kitchens of the Great Midwest, and that's what we will explore now. I want to ask you for a moment about the structure of the book, which I tried to describe in the introduction to this interview. It is a structure that I've never seen in a novel before, which is not to say it's not been used before, but never in anything I've read before. This framework in which each of these different chapters, are there eight chapters? I forgot to count. Are there eight chapters or more than that? Let's see. One, two, three, four, five, six. Yeah, eight chapters. And each one is told from the perspective of a different character.
Mm-hmm.
And this main character of Eva Thorvald is present in every single one of those, but she is only one of those chapters is primarily from her perspective. Otherwise, we are pivoting between different perspectives and in different places and in different times. And I may be describing that in a way that makes it sound wildly incoherent. And in fact, it's not. It works just brilliantly. But I'm just curious what was behind your choice to structure the novel in this way. And does it perhaps have anything to do with your background as a writer of short stories?
Wow. There were a lot of reasons I decided to structure the novel this way. And the main one was because I knew that the final event of the novel is going to be a large, opulent meal. Thanks. I'm glad we're editing. I felt like I had to portray a wide variety of Midwestern people and food the best I could. I mean, I certainly couldn't get everybody. But within the scope of a novel, I wanted diversity. I wanted different types of Midwesterners that I knew growing up, and I wanted different types of Midwestern food represented. But the first thing I had to do was write the menu that of the meal that served at the end and then work backwards. And in order to write the menu, I had to know, okay, well, what time of year is this dinner taking place? Because that's going to be very important, especially if the main character is a chef. What's in season? So what is the season? I picked a season, and I worked backwards, and I decided, okay, what's going to be on the plate? Okay, it's going to be venison, walleye, corn, you know. And I thought, okay, yeah, let's work backwards there, and let's represent the story through each chapter, focusing on a different type of Midwestern food that gets served in this meal. And let's tell the story of the chef through the people that introduce her to these ingredients. So essentially, the book would serve a twofold purpose of being a recipe for a human, for a chef, and also being a recipe for a meal. So I wanted the book to, in a sense, read like a recipe, with each of the chapters being ingredients as well as consecutive stories on a chronological timeline of a person's maturation into becoming a chef.
Hmm. Fascinating idea. How long did it take you to write this? And how many false starts, if you don't mind saying so, how many false starts were part of the building process? That is, as you had to sort of then create this through line after beginning with the culmination, how many sense sort of false leads or blind paths did you attempt before you settled on this wonderful array of stories that precede your finale?
Wow, that's a great question. First of all, I should say, like a lot of writers, I have a really big false start in my past. I have an unpublished and unpublishable novel I wrote in my 20s. And if it wasn't for that, I probably wouldn't have had the discipline and the mindset to write this novel. I learned a lot in writing the first unpublished novel about what it took for me to write a book. And that novel took me over 3 years to write, the one that will never see the light of day. Believe me, I'll never show it to anyone. It's terrible. But it had to exist. I got an idea of what my discipline would be, of how I would write every day. And when it came to write this one, it was all about breaking it down into manageable pieces. I had some false starts. There are a few chapters that I wrote that didn't make the book because ultimately I felt they were redundant with other chapters. But three of the first four chapters I wrote for Kitchens didn't end up making the final book. And,
wow.
And that was my decision. That was not my agent's or my editor's decision. Those chapters never even got to the agent or the editor. I called them before they even left my apartment. So I just had a sense of what was necessary for this book, and a lot of the early things didn't make the cut, and so I either reappropriated those ingredients or cut them, you know, or I just didn't tell the story of that particular ingredient anymore. So I did overwrite a little bit. There was a chapter called Early Girl about heirloom tomatoes. I wanted tomatoes to be part of the final meal. And that chapter didn't make the novel, but it did get published online on a website called Midnight Breakfast.
Oh.
And so you can read that chapter online as a bit of an outtake. I mean, it's the world is completely consistent with Kitchens. But I think you could also read it and see, I can see why he didn't put this in the book. The reason I didn't put it in was because in that chapter in Early Girl, it's about heirloom tomato enthusiasts who are trying to get their tomatoes to Eva to serve in the meal, and they don't know her. They just know her legend. You know, they know her anecdotally at best. several degrees of separation from them personally. And I already had that relationship represented in Pat Prager, probably most flagrantly, and a bit with Jordy, you know, who's like his brother is dating Eva. And I thought, well, okay, I already have chapters where Eva's really removed from the life of the narrator of that chapter, with Pat in particular. It came down to either Bars or Early Girl was going to be in the novel, and I just thought Bars was the stronger story. I really love Pat Prager, and I really like what that character added to the book, whereas Early Girl was a lot more comedic and light and satirical. And I already had those notes in the book, and I didn't have a character like Pat. So, yeah, Early Girl at least survives online somewhere.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, it was funny how that turned out. But it all came down to redundancy. But that's a really excellent question, because I know every writer is different, but I'm sure a lot, you know, just like me, you know, write things that they might feel are pretty good, but don't have a home here.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things that J. Ryan Straddle, he is the author of this marvelous debut novel called Kitchens of the Great Midwest, now available in paperback from Penguin Books. Tomorrow on the morning show, you're going to be hearing part two of our conversation as he delves more specifically into the structure of the book and some of the memorable characters and stories that are part of it. Part two of today's morning show coming up in just a second here on WGTD. Quick reminder that our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for cloudy and warm conditions today, with a 50% chance of rain and a high of 83 degrees. Our best chance of rain is actually tonight, and locally heavy rainfall is possible. Overnight low of 68 degrees. Tomorrow begins a sunny period and more comfortable temperatures. Tomorrow sunshine and a high of 82 degrees. Part two of today's morning show is from the archives. If you are someone who is looking at the encroachment of middle age, staring, for instance, at your 40th birthday, not too far off in the distance, or maybe you've already passed that and are already trying to come to terms with that, let alone with trying to come to terms with maybe 50 candles on your birthday cake sometime soon, then you might want to take in hand a book which is called Fortitude, Making the Next Decades the Best Years of Your Life Through the 40s, 50s, and Beyond. The author, Sarah Brokaw, is a licensed therapist. She practices in Beverly Hills, California, and she has worked with a wide range of people. This book is conceived mostly with women in mind, because it does seem to be women, by and large, who have some real struggles with the notion of turning 40. And her book tries to explore why that is, and to give some strategies, and in particular to talk about five core values which she sees lived out very powerfully in the lives of those women she has known and worked with who have transitioned most easily and happily into this phase of their lives. We might also add that Sarah Brokaw is a daughter of Tom Brokaw, the highly respected television journalist and a very fine author in his own right. Sarah Brokaw's new book, again, is called Fortitude, and it is published by Voice, a division of Hyperion. Sarah Brokaw, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks, Greg, and thanks for doing a wonderful job in introducing me in the book.
Well, you're very, very welcome. I wonder if I could just ask you a word about what it feels like to be another Brokaw entering the arena of writing. Did you do it with any kind of trepidation, or were you excited at the challenge?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think that, of course, I was going to you know, act with trepidation because, you know, my father is a renowned writer and a journalist, and I was stepping into his, onto his turf. And I really wanted to not have him feel as if I was trying to take over the Brokaw name. But that said, my dad has been so supportive of me and this journey that I've been on in writing this book. I also would consider myself really a psychotherapist by trade, more than a writer, whereas I consider my father as really being the writer of the family, of the Brokaw family.
This is a book which ends up being pretty personal in that you write it to some extent out of your own experience as a woman approaching her 40th birthday, and you also are not afraid to share about how part of the struggles which you have had stem from your own parents' values, the way life unfolded for them, and how life for you has unfolded in kind of a different fashion.
That's right. That's right. To expand on that, in my 20s, the only blueprint that I had in terms of how to navigate my future was my parents' blueprint. Them coming from, you know, Yankton, South Dakota, being married at the age of 22 and 21 and having a very successful marriage. You know, they're both blissfully wed. They also, you know, in my 20s had already accomplished so much. My mother had her own toy store business. My father obviously had done extraordinarily well for himself. He was the anchor of NBC Nightly News. And so I felt this daunting pressure that I had to carve out a path that was very similar to the path that they had carved out. And I think that in my 20s, you know, luckily my parents had encouraged me to listen to my own voice and carve out my own path. So I went to grad school and I got my master's in social work. I started to get very much into, you know, running marathons and traveling across the world and getting very much into photography. But I still had that nagging feeling that I was not doing enough, that I still was not following the path that they have carved out for themselves. And then I also think that that feeling was just exacerbated when I had looked at my two sisters who were very successful in their professions, who were married and who had children on their own. And I thought, well, what have I done wrong? And it was at one point where I think I was experiencing a moment of self-pity that my mother just looked at me and she just said, you have been, you know, given the opportunity to capitalize on your own strengths, now marry forth. And at that moment, I thought, she's absolutely right. I got to reframe my thinking here. And so I did. And it doesn't mean there are moments where I experience self-doubt or self-pity. Of course there can be moments, but it's my responsibility to change that type of thinking. And by doing that, I have to incorporate five essential values, which I do mention in the book, and that is grace, a sense of connectedness, accomplishment, adventure, and spirituality. And to do that, I think, with fortitude, I have to take the time to define those values in my own words.
Right.
And the minute I hear my family's voice or society's voice, I need to turn down the volume of the voices and just listen to my own voice.
That's a really interesting picture, and you write about it repeatedly, about how at a moment in your life when you are experiencing some doubt, there will be this voice, and it will be the voice of someone close to you, someone you care about. And I think someone, as they maybe first read your book, might be taken aback by that, because there are probably some people who, for them, it's a much more positive thing to sort of confront a challenge and hear the voice of a parent or a grandparent or someone in their head. And you're suggesting that it can be kind of a dangerous thing. And probably for some people in particular, that's something they have to really be careful about.
Well, it's interesting. I'm not saying that when we hear the voices, it can always be discouraging. Right. But I think that many times when we question the choice that we're supposed to make, it's really about feeling like we're seeking some type of approval. And this is something that I've experienced in my own life. This is something that I know that a number of my clients have experienced in my practice. When I ask them, like, whose voice are you hearing? It's usually, you know, a parental voice. And if I ask a number of people outside of my practice, they would agree with me. They do hear someone's voice other than their own when they're at a moment of self-doubt or self-pity.
Hmm. And
when I say self-pity, I'm not trying to put it down. It's just it's just a moment of not trusting ourselves and feeling bad.
Right. And that whole notion of listening for another voice rather than our own, that's
right.
What you're kind of cautioning people
that's
about.
Right. That's right.
I want to not let another moment go by without asking you why this seems to be a phenomenon that more powerfully impacts women than men. And your book is mostly written in such a way that it is clearly intended for women to read and to address the concerns of women around this. I suspect that you would believe that men are not entirely immune to this and that what you write about is not fully irrelevant to men. Help us understand what divide there is between men and women around this question, and if a man, for instance, potentially could take your book and take something away from it.
You know, that's such an excellent question. When I originally came up with the idea about writing this book, I really was just thinking about women. But as I was writing the book, a number of my male peers had said, I want this book. I need to get some guidance here. And it was interesting to hear about the reasons for their anxiety about going into their fifth decade and also going into their sixth decade. And even though the reasons may be different, there is still that overall anxiety, and I think it's just about the fear of uncertainty in life. I think for women, I think that some of the reasons are very obvious. I think that women who are in their mid-30s and who are not wedded and who don't have children really slowly but truly feel like they're not going to have the opportunity to find their mate or have children. Some of that is true because we do have to respond to our internal fertility clock. We're at our peak of fertility when we're 28, but when we hit 40, it's much more difficult to have successful pregnancy. Doesn't mean that there are women who can have, successful pregnancy, but it's a lot more difficult. I think that there's also the external reasons for women as well. I think that many women feel that they're no longer relevant, that society has told us, I don't know whether it could be explicitly or implicitly, that we are at our prime in our 20s. That is when we're given the permission to explore who we are. We can do whatever we want to do. The world is our oyster. But then when we really hit the fifth decade, we are not as relevant. Mm. And women are extremely aware of that.
Right. I think you really put your finger on it when you mentioned that as you approach 40, which is not old by most standards, you write, I no longer hear people telling me that I have my whole life ahead of me.
That's
the way
right.
that you would have been told that when you were 21 and 22 and 23.
Right.
And in that respect, one has this sense that certain doors have closed and certain possibilities are no longer possibilities for us.
That's right. And I think that, with men, I think that men may not have, obviously they don't have the fertility clock ticking. That's where they were extremely lucky. And I think that society has encouraged men to feel that that it's not too late. They still have a tremendous amount of time ahead of them. But I noticed that men are starting to really compare their incomes to their peers' incomes. And I always call it compare and despair. They really start to think about or define their success or lack of success by comparing their incomes. I also know a number of men who, in my own practice and outside of my practice, if they're not married and if they don't have kids, they start to really think about their fathers at that age. A number of them will say, well, I remember when my father would come home at the age of 40 or 45 and he'd take off his tie and take off his coat and he would sit down and my mom would have made dinner and his life was all together. And here I am, a bachelor, or I'm struggling to climb that corporate ladder. So there is something to be said about turning 40 for men as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure for us, many of these values that you talk about, grace, connectedness, accomplishment, adventure, spirituality, are every bit as important.
Absolutely.
And significant to our own well-being. Early in the book, actually during the introduction, you talk about a really intriguing concept, And I think it speaks so much to other things you explore in the book later that I think it's worth our just taking a moment to talk about it. And it's a notion of taking what we might call a problem and instead calling it a sparkling moment.
Yeah.
Those terms seem sort of polar opposites of one another. What are you talking about with sparkling moments in one's
sparkling
life?
Sparkling moments are moments when our fortitude is being tested. And that doesn't just start in our 30s. That goes from when we're in our childhood. And that's the moment, it's the pivotal moment where you can either respond to a situation with fear and regret, or you look at the situation with confidence and curiosity. And I personally have defined it as a sparkling moment because I like things that sparkle. It's not necessarily an aha moment, it's just a moment of revitalization and courage. And I'm just thinking about when I was, you know, for example, when I was 13 years of age, I was diagnosed with scoliosis. I had to wear a brace, you know, for 23 hours a day. Now, as you can imagine, as an adolescent, that was really embarrassing for me. And I was really mad that I had to wear this brace. But I had to take that opportunity. So I'm going to wear this brace, and I'm going to still play the sports I want to play, and I'm not going to focus on it. At that point, my fortitude was being tested. The next time that my fortitude was being tested was living in Japan on my own, thinking I can crawl up in a ball and not learn the language and sit in my room all day and not go out there. But I said, no, I got to do this for myself. Hmm. I think the next sparkling moment, and this is a moment where I really thought I need to write this book, is that I chose not to go to my 20th high school year reunion because I was not married. I didn't have kids. And I know that all my friends were married, and most of my friends had children. And I thought, well, I'm not going to walk in there. And I clearly was not allowing myself to have fortitude. I was succumbing to what society would define what it is to be relevant. So I said, well, I'm being a hypocrite here. I need to create a moment right now where I can say it doesn't matter if I have not been married or I don't have children. What matters is that I've made accomplishments for myself that I feel comfortable with.
Hmm. Your book, the body of the book, is filled with stories from other people with whom you have worked as a therapist, and many of the things that you have sort of discovered and learned on your own, they have learned in different ways. One really telling and timely observation you make as you talk about a woman named Juliet and some of her struggles is that this economic downturn in which we find ourselves has been for her, and potentially for a lot of other women and a lot of men for that matter, a similar sort of sparkling moment, a really perfect opportunity to reexamine, reevaluate, reassess who we are and what's important to us.
That's right. That's right. Especially now, especially with the economic downturn, I think this is the time where we are all extremely challenged. You know, some people are going to be in far worse situations than others, but I think that overall, I think that our country really is quite fearful of what our future holds economically. But this is the time where I would say it is that much more essential to focus on those five values and to foster those five values without thinking monetarily. So if you're a person who's really struggling financially, it's all the more important to contact your peers for support. Have a conversation. And if you don't feel comfortable, do find, you know, a financial manager, or do even find a therapist who's affordable where you can have this conversation. Don't experience fear.
Hmm.
You there?
Yes.
Okay. So I think that with Juliet, it's a perfect example. You know, luckily, she does have another job, and she has been able to find some success in this new job. But her message to me and her message to herself is that she's not letting money define her. She's not letting her career status define who she is. She's finding other ways to define who she is through the use of those five values.
And again, you can learn more about grace and connectedness and accomplishment, adventure and spirituality and what a difference it can make as one enters this phase of life in reading the book Fortitude by Sarah Brokaw, published by Voice. Sarah Brokaw, I have enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we hear more from the author with whom we began today's morning show, J. Ryan Straddle, talking about his debut novel, a bestseller called Kitchens of the Great Midwest. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of